This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. Today, an eclectic hour on the program. First, we hear about the world's largest supercomputer, Blue Waters, set to fire up next year. We'll do computational chemistry, quadrillion calculations per second. Three researchers at Iowa State will have access to the petascale power computer. We'll talk to one, Monica Lamb. And then on to the Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines, where their new baby dromedary camel needs a name. And finally, Jonathan Aull talks to the legendary singer-songwriter from Waterloo, Bonnie Kolak, now celebrating 40 years of music. Her new CD, Beginnings, brings you Bonnie in action at the legendary Chicago folk club, the Earl of Old Town. The tapes of her 1969 performances were recently discovered sitting on shelves in a friend's basement. Kolak sings a wide variety of songs from Dylan, Joni Mitchell, to the Beatles, and then her own song, Rainy Day Lady. Talk of Iowa following news next. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. The world's biggest computer goes online next year. It's called Blue Waters. It'll be located in Urbana, Illinois. It will operate at a petascale of speed. That's 10 to the 15th calculations per second. Handy if you're studying nanotechnology, such as how dendrimers can improve drug delivery and water treatment. Iowa State University researcher and professor of chemical and biological engineering, Monica Lamb, is one of three Iowa State staffers who will be able to use Blue Waters right after it's plugged in. Professor Lamb, why do we need a quadrillion calculations per second?
Well, the petascale part of this machine, the petascale computing, is really required for high accuracy in a lot of areas of scientific modeling, scientific computing. In computational chemistry is where we're focusing on that, and that is the petascale power is really helping us to solve computational chemistry problems in a way that we've never done before. Typically, in computational chemistry, when you have a problem in science that you want to solve, you have to look at what computing power is available and then simplify the scientific calculations to match the computing power. This petascale machine, Blue Waters, is now making the choice available to do our computational chemistry problems with full accuracy or full fidelity.
So what is the technical meaning of petascale? Because I've never run into this word before until I read about this.
So petascale refers to the ability of the computer system to sustain one petaflop performance.
So this is operating at a quadrillion calculations per second. Could you put that in plain English for me? I mean, how many calculations is that and some other number that I can grasp?
Sure. So a quadrillion is 10 to the 15th, and so that would be like having, in terms of millions of things, that's like having a billion of a million objects.
Oh, my gosh. 10 to the 15th. Amazing.
It's one quadrillion calculations per second.
So this source of new and improved computing power is called Blue Waters, a supercomputer that's being developed as a joint effort of a number of organizations. And when will this computer, Blue Waters, be finished and ready to go?
It should be available in mid-year in 2011.
And why do they call it Blue Waters, or why did they come up with that name?
That is a good question, and I actually don't know the answer to the waters part. The blue would be, you know, IBM, big blue.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I think waters, and I would have to check on this, but one of the sponsors is the Great Lakes Consortium for petascale computing, and so I'm wondering if waters comes from that.
Mm-hmm.
But I would have to look up the history of that. That's a very good question. No one's asked me that before.
Well, anyway, it's a nice name. When it's finished, will this be, what, the biggest computer in the world?
Yeah, it'll be the first of its kind to sustain this one petaflop performance.
And so this implies that the University of Illinois and Iowa State and some other organizations, we've beaten the rest of the world to get this this fast of a computer actually built and up and running.
That's right. And that's one of the interesting things of working on this project is, because the world of high-performance computing is so competitive, you never stay at the top for very long. And so a lot of the information about the architecture of the machine and the supporting software is proprietary information. And getting the information to developers like our group is tricky, and things are, understandably so. The developers of the machine are protective of that information, yet software developers need access to that information. So it's a very tricky balance of releasing and for us obtaining information about the machine as it's being developed. But like I said, high-performance computing is very competitive. And so once a machine is rolled out, it will be at the top, and then, just remains to be seen how long it stays there, because things are always changing.
Where is the computer actually located then, Professor Lamb?
Yeah, it's at the University of Illinois, at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications, or NCSA.
What's it look like? How big is it physically?
I have not been to the NCSA and seen it, and that's ironically a lot of what people do in high performance computing is we very rarely see the machines because they are so large and they're located in a certain geographic area, but because we can access them remotely, there's not a real need to see the machines.
So I don't need to ask you what color it is.
No, but I don't know if it's blue. Yeah.
But you can access it from your office at Iowa State.
Yeah, that's the idea, and that's been a trend in supercomputing for a number of years now, is that the user does not have to be on site, so we remotely connect.
Will you be assigned time then to Blue Waters once it gets started? I mean, I'm thinking of the Hubble telescope. Astronomers, reserve so much time per month or something. Is that the way it works with these mammoth computers?
It does. And actually, the one of the grants we have right now, it's a PRAC, stands for Provisional Resource Allocation, that we had to compete to get access to this preliminary information about the machine as it's being built to develop our software to take full advantage of the petaflop performance that's being built. And that is our gateway to gaining time on the machine Blue Waters when it's available in 2011. The way NSF, the National Science Foundation, sort of proposed this idea was that if you competed for a PRAC and didn't get one, you would not be able to then get future time on the Blue Waters machine. So we were very happy to get the PRAC grant because that is the only gateway into having computer time on Blue Waters in 2011.
Professor Lamb, how will Blue Waters be useful to you? It says that I understand you're an expert on complex molecular binding, and I may ask you to talk about that for a bit. But what will you be using it for, and how useful will it be in your research?
Yeah, we are studying dendritic polymers in my research group, and dendritic polymers are a highly branched polymer, which is a high molecular weight molecule, and there are a lot of applications for these dendrimers in health technology, so for example, drug delivery and tissue engineering, as well as environmental technologies such as water treatment and soil remediation, because these large molecules will bind either therapeutic molecules in a health application or contaminant species in environmental applications. And so we are going to use Blue Waters to produce the first accurate calculations of how dendrimers bind small molecular species. And through that information, we can design better dendrimers or better technologies that harness the binding capabilities of the dendrimer.
So this research into dendrimers, this is sort of what, in nanotechnology? Does it fall in that category?
It does. It falls into nanoscience and nanotechnology. Exactly. Yeah.
You are one of a number of people at Iowa State, and I assume other United States universities that will be using this new supercomputer, tops in the world. What are some of the other researchers using it for at Iowa State?
Right. Well, we're definitely a part of a team. Professor Mark Gordon is studying the molecular dynamics of water. Water, of course, is ubiquitous in a lot of systems, and with computational chemistry, the behavior of water has never been able to be modeled with full accuracy. And so he has a novel method that looks at large large numbers of water molecules and is able to study that with high accuracy chemistry calculations by splitting it into fragments. And so when Blue Waters is released, he will be able to perform the first high accuracy simulations of water in the world. So we're excited about that. Professor Teresa Windus is studying the way aerosols form in the atmosphere, and she's really looking at how particulate matter in the atmosphere grows starting from the molecular level, so from the first molecular species that participate in that particle formation. If we can get a handle on that process, the nucleation of these particles, we can better understand the chemistry of the atmosphere. And, of course, there's a lot of nice environmental implications for that.
When the supercomputer Blue Waters opens for business next year, what's the first thing you're going to do with it?
Right. We will be looking at dendrimer ligand binding. In particular, we have a couple of contaminant species that we're studying. And so we'll basically be thinking about this in terms of with an environmental focus. So how does a dendrimer bind small organic contaminant species? And comparing that to some of the experimental data that's available so that we can come up with models for dendrimer ligand binding.
And as you mentioned, someday, probably some other, maybe soon, some other computer somewhere in the world will surpass or exceed Blue Waters, maybe even if after it's been operating for just a few months. I suppose that's possible, huh?
Yeah.
We'll enjoy it while we have it, don't we?
Yeah.
Professor Lamb, thanks a lot. Appreciate the time and good luck using Blue Waters.
Hey, thank you very much, and I enjoyed talking with you.
Monica Lamb is professor of chemical and biological engineering at Iowa State University, where she's one of three researchers at Ames Laboratory who will use the petascale power computer to assist with her research into dendrimers, a part of nanotechnology, which could have applications in health technologies such as drug delivery and water treatment. Coming up in the next segment of Talk of Iowa, naming the baby camel, at the Blank Park Zoo, a contest going on now. Talk of Iowa continues. I'm Dennis Reese. A baby camel needs a name. It's a dromedary. The little guy was born on April 11th at the Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines. Zoo officials are asking for suggestions from the children of Iowa. They've got at least 100 possible names submitted so far. The winner of the naming contest receives a family four-pack of day passes to the zoo and lots more, including, of course, a camel ride. I talked to Ryan Bickle of the Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines. Ryan, you have a new baby male dromedary camel at the Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines. Problem is, he doesn't have a name.
Correct. Yeah, that's right. We have a baby male dromedary camel, and we're asking the kids of Iowa, ages 12 and under, to help us pick the name.
Oh, you mean I can't suggest a name? I have a perfect name, but anyway.
Well, you know, we did have a parent call sort of suggest a name and say that it was for their kid, but no, it should be the kids, yeah.
Okay, I understand. Well, tell me about the baby dromedary. When was he born? And I saw his picture on your website. He's as cute as he can possibly be.
Yeah, he was born April 11th, and he was born 4 foot tall and about 90 pounds, and he's grown a little bit since then, but not too much.
Mm-hmm.
And when the camels are born, they're usually white. They're not the tan color that you're used to seeing a camel, but they get that way over the next year or so.
Oh, so is this the case with all camels, that they're born white?
The baby camels I've seen are that way.
How many names have been suggested so far? I know you're going to continue with this through the end of May.
Well, I haven't counted them up yet, but we've had quite a few come in so far, probably 100 or so. So
wow.
We'll have some. We'll have a job ahead of us trying to sort through them and pick a name.
So will he live at the Blank Park Zoo for the rest of his life?
The camels at the Blank Park Zoo come every year.
Oh,
so,
see.
No, he won't live at the Blank Park Zoo for the rest of the.
So he stays for, what, the summer, then he goes someplace else?
He stays for the summer, and then he goes back home down to Missouri.
Ryan, I don't want to try to, uncover classified information here, but could you mention maybe a few of the names that the kids have suggested for him so far?
Well, we've had just about everything. I saw one where they took the two camels that are here, Cotton and Molly, and combined them. Someone suggested Igor because Igor had a hump. I've seen a couple of others as well.
So you have other camels at the zoo?
Yeah, we have two female camels that give the rides at the zoo, and one of the camels is the mother of the baby.
And her name is what?
It's Molly.
Okay, so you have Molly, and then the other female is?
Yeah, Molly is the mom, and Cotton is the other female.
Yeah. What can you tell us, Ryan, about dromedaries? Because most people think camels have two humps, but not the dromedary.
Yeah, dromedary camels just have one hump. Camels are basically domesticated now, and there's only one group of camels in Australia that live sort of in the wild as feral camels. So most every camel now is like horses or whatever. They've been domesticated. One thing that most people don't know about camels is they don't store water in their humps. The humps are a fatty tissue, and then when camels go without water, that hump, that fatty tissue, is metabolized into something that is like a water for them.
And the dromedary camel is one of the better known members of the camel family. What are some other members of the camel family?
The Bactrian camel has two humps, so that would be the other camel that you've probably seen in movies and at different places is the Bactrian camel.
And the llama is considered part of the camel family, right? The alpaca and so forth.
Sure, they're in that same family.
So a lot of people think that they're sort of disagreeable creatures, kind of grouchy, but what are they like, and I won't say in person, what are they like to be around?
Well, my experience is they're pretty friendly creatures, and of course, they're friendly enough that, we give rides here at the zoo. Some of our other animals, like giraffe or lions, tigers, we really can't even go in with those animals because they're not so friendly. But a camel is pretty agreeable. Of course, you got to be careful around every animal, and that's why we have trained staff to help people out with the camel ride.
Well, let's talk about some of the other activities. Of course, it's May, and Ryan, I'm sure the Blank Park Zoo has lots of things going on. And what are some of the activities scheduled for this summer?
Starting May 15th, we're going to have a food festival called Feast in the Wild, and we have 10 restaurants from the Des Moines area that you will be able to come to the zoo and eat a whole lot of good food. And it's from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. We're also going to have music from Douglas Akers and Matt Woods and the Thunderbolts and Rudy York. There'll be chef demonstrations and a whole lot more. And that's May 15th for Feast in the Wild. And then starting in June, every Friday night, June through August, is Family Friday Night. And the zoo stays open late till 8 p.m. So people that are working or whatever, they can come to the zoo in the evening time and bring the family out. There's music, kids' activities, craft activities. We usually have some sort of theming where it's about a certain animal or a certain type of animal every Friday night. And then for the adults, on Wednesdays in June and July, we have what we call Zoo Brew. And Zoo Brew is for 21 years and older, and there's usually some sort of adult beverage tasting, so brew tasting or wine tasting, and that's every Wednesday night in June and July.
I haven't been to the zoo in Des Moines for a few years. What's changed? Are you growing? Are there more animals, more things to see than there were a few years ago?
Well, in 2001, we opened the Myron and Jackie Blank Discovery Center, and that was a $7 million indoor exhibit that has a rainforest and aquariums, that sort of thing. We've added some other animals since then, but they haven't been the big, huge exhibits. But last year we added red pandas, and red pandas are really cool. They are small. They're not like a big bear. They're small, sort of like a raccoon, but they sort of have this reddish maroon coat on them, and they're really furry and fluffy, and everybody that sees them just thinks they're as cute as can be.
And so the red pandas are not related to the big pandas?
They're not closely related. They call them pandas because they both eat bamboo.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Yes.
What other interesting animals are there to see?
Well, one of the fun things I like to do at the zoo is giraffe feeding, and we offer this on the weekends in May, and every day throughout the summer is giraffe feeding. And you get a giraffe treat, and the giraffe sticks out its 17-inch long purple tongue, and you're right there with the giraffe, and you're able to feed them.
What do they like to eat, or what are the treats? Some a vegetarian or what?
It's a Rye Krisp cracker. And so the giraffe love to eat them, and it's good for them. And
yeah, and they're vegetarians, right? And so are the camels too, right?
Sure. Yeah. They're both herbivores.
Right.
I think the Blank Park Zoo is going to have a great summer. We're also going to have this summer. We're going to have parakeet feeding, and the parakeets. You buy a stick with seed on it for $1. Starting June 1st, we're going to have parakeet feeding at the Blank Park Zoo, and you buy a stick for $1, and it has bird seed on it, and the birds will fly down to your hand and eat the bird seed right out of your hand. It's a pretty neat experience. So that's a nice thing that's going to go on this summer. And then starting July 3rd, we will have the Birdman, and he is going to have an all-Australian bird show this summer, and so that will be pretty neat. We had him last year with some other birds, and he's coming back with all new Australian birds this year.
Wow. And for the kids who want to name the baby male dromedary camel, what's the procedure? Do you have to appear at the zoo and fill out a slip of paper or something? How's that working?
Yeah, if you want to name the baby camel, just go to our website, blankparkzoo.com, and you can download the form there and mail it to us, or you can get a form here at the Blank Park Zoo or the camel ride.
Yeah, I have to tell you my name. First thing that came to mind would be Felix. Felix the ungulate, you know.
Yeah.
Felix Unger from The Odd Couple.
But sure, yeah.
I don't know if anybody's come up with that yet. Anyway, Ryan, thanks a lot. Sounds like a lot of fun things going on at the Blank Park Zoo. I hope the baby camel, hope he gets a great name.
Yeah, I think we'll get a lot of good suggestions, and thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you.
Ryan Bickel is with the Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines. The contest to name the baby dromedary camel runs through May 31st.
Always long to say I love you. Always been too high above you.
This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan All. In the late 60s and early 70s, the Chicago folk music scene was centered on a little bar called the Earl of Old Town, and one of the voices that defined the sound was Waterloo native Bonnie Kolak.
Starshine, starshine, chills the moon upon my cheek.
Bonnie Kolak has just issued a CD of recordings made at the Earl of Old Town and another venue more than 40 years ago. It's called Beginnings. Bonnie Kolak joins us from our studio in Cedar Falls. And Bonnie, tell us the story of how these recordings came to light and why you chose to release them.
a friend of mine, Chuck Osgood, who's been a photographer for the Chicago Tribune for a very long time, was just a young person in school, going to school in Chicago, college, and had heard me when I first went to Chicago, which was been like 1968, and I was working at a place called The Quiet Night, which was down on South Wells Street. And Chuck wanted to meet me, and so somehow he was going to do an article and wound up taking photographs for my first album. At the same time, then shortly after that, I went up and started working at a club up north on Wells Street called The Quiet Night. The Earl of Old Town. And Rich Warren, who was also probably college, maybe before college, was sort of an apprentice with Ray Nordstrand, who was from WFMT, the Fine Arts Chicago station. And he would come into the Earl with Rich Warren would come in with Ray Nordstrand and could get in because he was with Ray, because he was too young to come into the club. And so he recorded one of my sets at the Earl and asked if he could, and I said sure. And then later, I think he recorded, it's on the album or on the CD. It was at another concert. It might have been at Circle Campus in Chicago. I'm not quite sure. But anyway, apparently Chuck had horse traded some photographs to Rich for the tape, and they were reel to reel. So they were in Chuck's basement for probably 40 years, and he just found them a couple years ago and didn't know where they had been recorded, or like who had recorded them. And then we found out that Rich Warren had recorded them, and they really liked them and wanted to put them out. And I said, no, I'm rushing here. I'm doing that. I don't know if I want people to hear this. So we didn't do anything for a couple of years. And then Jules Everhart, who's been really helpful in getting me to do CDs and put stuff out recently, said, Bonnie, you should listen to these again. So I sat down, and we picked 12 or 14. And I said, well, let's call it Beginnings, because it's really when I was first learning. I had sung here, you know, in Cedar Falls area 5 years before I went to Chicago. But really in Chicago is where I was becoming a performer, a singer, really as a life work.
You said that at first you had a lot of trepidation, but then you listened to them again and agreed to it. What changed? What made you think, yes, you should do this?
Well, for one thing, I needed a CD to come out. I was going to record Howard Levy, who is my producer and my dear friend, and he's Chicago, New York, harmonica player, piano player. Had been playing in Europe so much, and I hate to record, and Howard's really the only person I'll work with to do that. And he was so busy, and I wasn't ready to record new material. They kept saying, listen to this again. And so what I did, I tried to listen in a less critical way, and that it was, I think maybe in the biography of your musical life, it's good to look back and see what you did early on, just like as a visual artist, you know. But so I just tried not to be as critical and to see what was unique and beautiful about them.
Did you listen to it from a musical standpoint or from a letting yourself reminisce about what was going on at the time?
Yes, trying to be back, knowing this was like someone who was just like 23 years old. And some of the intensity bothered me. You know, I kept thinking they're too intense and stuff. But that's part of what it is. And I think when you're younger, you know, you have a lot more angst. And that goes into your music.
Moons and Junes and Ferris wheels, the dizzy dancing way you feel when all your fairy tales come real. I've looked at love that way, but now it's just another show.
and you leave them laughing when you go. And if you care, don't let them know. Don't give yourself away.
This song, Both Sides Now, one of my favorites on the CD, and it spoke to you too when you listened back to these tapes?
It absolutely did. That I thought was a really quite a good performance. I did not take it from Judy Collins. When I first started years ago, people used to say, you sound just like Judy Collins. And because we both have a clear, well, my voice is a contralto and maybe Judy's is too, I don't know. I really learned it from the singing of Joni Mitchell early on and before Judy had recorded it. And it spoke to me so much. It was just such a beautiful song. And I remember the Earl used to have fireplaces, like one on each side of the stage, and the crackling of real logs burning and the flickering of the flames and the magic of singing these beautiful words with just a guitar and having a whole place packed, an audience that literally were silent. It was one night when I was singing, I felt like I was floating up in the air near the ceiling. It was just so incredibly wonderful. And so this performance, I thought, worked really well.
When you listen to these songs, or this song, Both Sides Now, or really any of the songs, do you have a different interpretation? Does it have a different meaning to you hearing it through the ears of someone who's lived an additional 40 years than someone who had 23 years under her belt when she first interpreted the
song?
Well,
you know, I had a really kind of bizarre childhood, and so I had a lot of angst from my childhood that I could put into my music. And I also was very lonely. And so it wasn't like some airhead singing these things. I sort of had been like, it's almost like I felt like I didn't really have a childhood. I was always kind of depressed and thought a lot about life. Yes, you have 40 years later, but you know, it's almost like the song seems, I don't know. It's like I probably wouldn't sing it now.
Why not?
It seemed like a young song to me.
When you listen back to these songs on Beginnings, are there any of them that don't really resonate at all with you anymore?
Oh, Amelia Earhart, I've apologized to her on the back of the CD. Because so many nights, it was so much fun at the Earl.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of this song, which is okay. Amelia Earhart's Last Flight.
All right.
With their partner, Captain Noonan, on the 2nd of July, her plane fell in the ocean far away.
When I listen to it, I get this image of a group of musicians and friends that are having a good time. What was going on? Do you remember when you recorded that track and the laughter and the fun?
Well, they had Jim Johnson, a very wonderful character who had grown up with Earl. He was an African-American man who was just fantastic. I loved him. And he was the bartender, and then there was also another bartender, and there was Earl would be there a lot of times, and he was a West Side Chicago guy, and Gus Johns, who was the Albanian doorman, who always had a flat top and wore white socks. They were all, it was just, and then Anton, who was the cook, and Anton was this very old German man who used to be cook on a circus. And there were a variety of waitresses who were anything from school teachers to secretaries. So it was like the whole place was, it was like, it had become my home. I had Thanksgiving dinner there. I'd bring food. The waitresses would bring food. Christmases were spent there. It was really a camaraderie. And we'd play often. Like Steve would play on New Year's Eve, and he would dress up and like in a tuxedo. It was so crazy. And there would be people off the street. There was Gloria the stripper. One night, Brian Bowers, who was a auto harp player. I mean, he's still one of our country's really beautiful auto harp players. And there was a stripper who was dancing in front of him. And the stage was like just about 6 inches high. And you could put your drink on the table if you were on stage. And so it was packed. The place was really the place to go. And it was kind of long and narrow. And the stage was in the middle facing the bar. And actually, on one of the songs in here, I think that you can hear the cash register. And I have some tapes at home where it was Silent Night, and it was almost in time. It was a Christmas performance, and it was almost in time with the cash register and the door opening. So it was really a place of a lot of characters off the street. They had... oh, gosh, there were just lots of stories that I can think of. I probably should write it down.
Do you remember specifically what was happening in this performance of Amelia Earhart, or was it just everybody having fun?
It was everybody having fun, but the audience was having fun. So it was, and then the bar, you know, the bartenders and stuff would really sing very loudly. And I had a bass player George, who was very fun, and Ray, and they were just being really silly and trying, you know. So it was like everybody laughing, and I mean, I just really believe that music is a celebration, and it's a celebration for the audience and the performer. So it was a very intimate, small. You know, people were very close to you when you were singing. I mean, you literally could put your drink on their table, and which was good and bad sometimes because it was so smoky. They'd also have their cigarettes under your nose. But it was just a crazy place, and the hamburgers frying, and they used to have candles that were dripping candles, and so they'd build up to these really monumental pieces of sculpture, and they'd have them burning at the bar. It was a real celebration. It was fun, and it was during an incredible political era.
Researching this, and this is all predates me by a few years, but it strikes me that the Earl of Old Town was like the hippest, coolest, most wonderful place and this hotbed of all this great folk music. I mean, between San Francisco and New York, this was the number one place in the middle of the country for this kind of music. And whenever anyone writes about this era and this time, they talk about you and John Prine and Steve Goodman and kind of talk about this Chicago folk scene. When you look back on it and when you listen to Beginnings, do you feel that there really was a scene and you were one of the top three people that cultivated it?
Well, when I went to Chicago in 1968, folk music was really on the wane as on popular radio. It had already been Peter, Paul, and Mary and all of that stuff. So really it was sort of on the wane as far as popular music on the radio. And it was coming in to more rock and roll and hard rock and stuff. And actually it was mixing with folk music. But because of the Old Town School of Folk Music, which was started by Win Strachey and a few other people, it was sort of like these people in middle age who had started a folk music school. And it was on North Avenue, and people could go there and take guitar lessons, banjo lessons. And it wasn't just because of what was in, because really folk music, the Weavers were, you know, that had been all before then, previous. So actually, when I got into folk music, it wasn't really because it was popular. I got into it kind of through the back door, and it was already kind of becoming not like it was changing. It was starting to go into pre Carole King. So it was sort of group things, like Spanky and our gang were from Chicago, and Spanky had just left Chicago. So it was kind of like this new group of people, myself, Steve, and John came a little later, but we kind of filtered through the Old Town School. I didn't because they went to school there, though, mm-hmm. and took lessons. Here, I had done my own thing here and went into Chicago and walked in off the street and got a job and went up to the Earl and started. People came to hear me because it was just word of mouth. And so John came a bit later. In fact, Steve came to me one night and said, "You have to hear this guy." He was a postman from Melrose Park who was taking lessons at the Old Town School. And he was playing, they used to go over on Thursday night after the classes to this little bar and they'd have open mic. So Steve took me over to hear John and I was blown away. Here's this guy who was singing like "There's a Hole in Daddy's Arm Where All the Money Goes." It was about the Vietnam War and people coming back, vets coming back, and songs about old people. And I mean, it was just, he was a natural, incredibly gifted writer. And I remember the first night I met him, I said, "John, you never have to worry about anything because your gift is going to bring you through." And so then later he came up to the Earl, but I think that might have been like about, might have been 71 or 2 or something. So Steve and I were at the Earl before then. I was working with Fred Holstein and I would do 5 shows a night. I just told that to somebody the other day. I said, you know, Earl had a 5 o'clock license on Saturday night, and I would start at 10 o'clock and do 5 shows when I first started. It was a lot of singing.
As long as we've been talking about Steve Goodman, let's listen to a little bit of Song for David.
David put down his head and he covered his face and he asked himself why he had bothered to race with the sun, for he knew who had won. He thought standing still would have been a mistake, for he knew out in front all the risks he would take. And he can't help but thinking that it's all been a fake, and this race had been fixed long before it had even been run.
The first week or two when I arrived in Chicago in the spring of 1968, might have been about April, I ran into a guy by the name of Guy Gilbert, and he did some jingles in Chicago and recordings. And I went up to his house to rehearse something. He was a bass player. And here was this young man with the most sparkling brown eyes. His mother, Minette, is a good friend, and Steve had her eyes. And he was sitting on the couch there with his guitar. And that's when I met Steve, and he was like 18 or 19 years old. Shortly after, just a few months later, we found out that Steve had leukemia, and he almost died in Chicago when he got that. And they sent him to Sloan Kettering Cancer Hospital in New York City. And I had met someone who said they wanted to record, you know, have me come to New York and record. So I went off to New York, and I was staying with friends. I never did record, but I was in New York City for a couple of months and went up to see Steve at the hospital. And I do believe that this may have been his first song that he had written. And he had written it for David. His brother is David, and called it For David, but it was really about Steve's situation at that point in his life. And so Actually, I introduced it. I left the introduction on the CD and talked about it, this young man who worked at the Earl, sang at the Earl, and who was becoming a very good writer. In fact, he went on later to write, of course, everyone knows, Riding on the City of New Orleans. And I was there at the Earl the first night that he had gotten back from that train ride and said, I have a new song. He knew he had a good one. And he got up and sang it for us at the Earl and just blew us away.
When you listen back on this CD, how do you see it fitting in with your career? How do you see it as literally the beginning of what you've done over the last 40 years?
I really began here, you know, but mm-hmm. no one knows that. Most people think I'm from Chicago. So when I went to Chicago, I really didn't know anyone and walked in off the street and auditioned. So this is from that really early period of being in a totally new place and just the starting of my career in Chicago. You know, it made me very sad. I couldn't listen to these things for a while because you realize that all this time has gone by and I love what I do so much. I wish I could have 40 more years to perform and sing.
Maybe you will.
I doubt it.
The CD is Beginnings from Bonnie Kolak. More information on her website, www.bonniekolak.com. That's BonnieKolak.com.
I think this was written a year ago. It's kind of appropriate for today. It's called Rainy Day Lady.
Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Our producer today is John Pemble and Dennis Reese. You can learn more about the show on our website, iowapublicradio.org. You can send us comments anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Jonathan Aull.